My boyfriend was abusive. I dated him from ages 13 to 16. He was 3 years older and my brother's best friend. One day we were walking down a major road in my town and he punched me in the back. A car pulled over and a man and a woman got out. It was a tiny car and the people looked normal, the man wearing a Blockbuster t-shirt. They informed us that they were undercover DEA and had seen what happened. They separated us, the woman talked to me and the man talking to him. I don't remember exactly what the woman said to me, but she was very mean, blaming me and telling me that I needed to stand up for myself and leave him. I looked over at my boyfriend, and he and the male officer were laughing. I was 14 at the time, and my boyfriend was 17. I should have been protected, but I was blamed and shamed. Fast forward to when I am 16, and I finally have the courage to leave. This is so embarrassing to this day because it doesn't make any sense. I was 16, working my first job at Denny's, and my parents had separated. My mom and I were living in an apartment by ourselves, but she was dating a man who lived 3 hours away and was gone a lot. One night, I was alone, and my now ex-boyfriend knocked on the door. He told me he had been beat up and was homeless and just wanted to sleep on my couch for the night. I said fine and went back to sleep. In the morning, he left without incident. In retrospect, I think what happened was he stole a key from my apartment that night. Things around my house disappeared. We had a yelling match with the upstairs neighbor one night. Finally, one day I came home with my brother this time and found my ex's backpack at my computer with the computer logged into my accounts. We also found in my mother's closet there had been an attic access and the door was now missing. Not knowing what to do, we called our mother, who said she would come home and we needed to call the police. My brother left and it was my mom and I home when the police came. It turns out my ex had been living in my attic without my consent or knowledge. I felt so dumb, but why would that be the first thing I think is going on? Anyway, this cop also blamed me. He told my mother I was probably lying and hadn't broke up with him, but instead had allowed my boyfriend to sleep in our attic and was now covering my tracks. I was 16 and he was 19. They did not care one bit about protecting me. Everything was my fault. My ex-boyfriend was stalking me from my own apartment, and it was somehow my fault, and I was unworthy of protection. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about male supremacy. But before we get started, I would like to ask you to help support this podcast by sharing it on social media, by leaving a positive review on your favorite podcast platform, by heart rate reacting it. By doing all of the things that you can do to engage. And I know it's annoying to hear, and I know it's annoying to get the reminder, but social media algorithms thrive on engagement, which means podcasts thrive on engagement because we have to give these algorithms what they want. So the most effective way to push back against these social media algorithms that so often punish feminist and leftist creators is to give them that engagement they want. If you really love the podcast, you can also sign up to become a paid subscriber. If you do, you'll get at least one bonus episode a month, as well as 8 bonus essays on top of the usual stuff that free subscribers get. These actions to promote the podcast and to promote my work really do help. Subscribers are the sole reason I am able to do this work, and your support and promotion helps me keep doing it. I will never accept advertiser money or allow this work to be censored or sell it to someone else. So I'm dependent solely on you, my listeners, and I'm really grateful that you are here. My guest today is the wonderful Soraya Chevalley. Soraya is an award-winning author and activist who writes on topics related to gender norms, inclusivity, social justice, free speech, sexualized violence, and technology. She is the director and co-founder of Women's Media Center Speech Project. She is also the author of Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger, The Resilience Myth, and the newly released All We Want Is Everything. You can find her articles in numerous publications and anthologies, in talks and media appearances, and just about everywhere anyone is discussing gender. And today we are going to be talking about Soraya's new book, All We Want Is Everything. Soraya, thank you so much for coming back to the podcast. I know that listeners are so excited to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for having me again, Zahn. It's delightful to be here with you.
Well, I know we talked about this a bit before we started recording, but I just want to emphasize this book is really, really good. It's It has a lot of
Too.
substance, but it's pretty short and it's very to the point. And I feel like it would be a wonderful introduction to feminism. It's a great book to convince people of why we need feminism, but it's also really educational to oldies like me who feel like we've read and seen everything. So it's just great. I love
Oh,
it so
thank you.
much. So tell me, this book is a little bit different from your other books because your other books were more theory oriented. This is really like punchy and to the point and heavy on statistics. Tell me how you decided to write this book and what you hope it accomplishes.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me on again and for reading the book. That means a lot to me. I, as you said, my prior books tend to be big, thick, lots of citations, heavy on theory. And this one I really wanted to be as succinct as possible about one particular issue that we, I think, culturally, socially, politically, are very resistant to thinking about, which is male supremacy. Part of the problem, at least in the United States, I think, is this American exceptionalism that women here are just better off than women anywhere else in the world, which is objectively not true, right? Certainly, there are places in the world where women are terribly violently oppressed in more extreme ways, but that doesn't mean that women in the United States are automatically not, right? And so, in the wake of, not even in the wake of, I conceived of the book in the months before the 2024 election because it was really just striking to me that no matter who won that election, there was going to be a backlash and that it would be very anti-feminist. And if Kamala Harris had won, it would, of course, have been more pointedly white supremacist and anti-feminist. So lots of misogynoir. And so I wanted to write about that and say, hey, this is just something we cannot look aside from. We can't afford it anymore, particularly since this militant masculinity of the right is, it's a pivotal foundational element of authoritarianism, fascism, and we need to name it.
So I'm struck by this use of the term male supremacy. I find when I'm writing about misogyny, patriarchy, whatever you want to call it, I'm sometimes not very thoughtful in my language, and I'll use sexism, misogyny, patriarchy interchangeably. It's clear to me that you're really careful in your use of this term, and I wonder if you would talk to me about like what this term means to you and why you use it.
So, I think all of us grapple with this. All of us every day are trying to capture nuanced, complicated ideas with insufficient language often, right? And the thing about words like sexism and racism is that they maintain the barriers between different types of oppression to the detriment most, mostly of the people who live in those intersections, who embody those intersections. And so male supremacy, actually just going to read the definition because it's a good definition. It's from the Institute on the Study of Male Supremacism. The definition helps with that. The definition allows us to capture a much broader spectrum of ideas so that we can connect ideas like white supremacy and male supremacy more effectively. So their definition is the belief in cisgender men's superiority and right to dominate, control, or erase others. And others can mean in that context women, trans and non-binary people, and those with indigenous gender social roles. And I would add to that, as I do in the book, people who are feminized in the process of as a way to oppress them in a society. So Black men suffer from male supremacism in that they are feminized by white supremacy. All of the attributes of masculinity that give white men power and leverage in the society are denied to Black men systemically, right? And so that's how I would expand it. And I try and explain in the beginning that I'm not talking about gender equality per se, which I think is ultimately male supremacist in the way that it has been interpreted, or patriarchy being a set of institutions and gender equality or inequality being a set of outcomes.
That's okay. I really appreciate you clarifying that because I often struggle. I have one of my good friends is the racial justice educator, Desiree Stevens, and she used the term supremacy culture. So I've sort of stolen that from her
Yeah,
and
that's
started,
exactly right. That's a really great term.
and started using that. But I also appreciate the idea that male supremacy is about more than just oppressing women. And when we say women, of course, we often picture like white middle class women. So that's helpful.
Yeah, and when and you know, actually in my book, The Resilience Myth, I write a lot about supremacy culture from the perspective of having we have these Western European epistemologies that are really structured around the success and power of cisgendered white men in society. And we see that over and over and over again in our philosophy and our medical practices and our laws. You know, it's just once you start looking at it, you can't unsee it. And so there is a superstructure of supremacy culture. And really, all I'm trying to do in this book is say, don't look away from this aspect of it, right? Like you will never understand white supremacy if you don't understand male supremacy, and vice versa.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So I want to talk about some of the aspects of male supremacy that you talk about. But before we get to that, I want to talk to you about something that you talk about quite a bit in the book, and you don't really like have a chapter on it, but I see this theme sprinkled within. And it's this idea that we pretend that male supremacy doesn't exist. And the way that we do that is by pretending that acts of oppression are just individual failings. So it's not, for example, that husbands systematically exploit their wives' labor so that they can get ahead and get more leisure time. It's that she just needs to communicate better. You know, it's not that male violence is normal and normalized with few options to support survivors, as we saw in that opening vignette. It's that she's too dumb to know she needs to leave. You know, it's not that sexual violence is just a completely normal part of girlhood. It's that, you know, teenage girls make bad decisions and girls are too promiscuous. It's not that patriarchy creates this impossible double bind where women must be beautiful while pretending not to want to be beautiful and must be thin without appearing to work for thinness. It's that women are shallow narcissists who just love having eating disorders
And manipulate, they're
and
manipulators.
manipulative and entitled. Yeah. So why do you think that male supremacy is so good at convincing us that these clearly, political problems are just personal failings.
I mean, if you can create systems that normalize the inequality, then you use them, right? So if you think about it, religious systems, educational systems, and I know people think that schools are dominated by women, which honestly, I don't even want to get into that, but I disagree for a variety of reasons, right? They might be numerically dominated in terms of the number of teachers in like K through 12 education, but once you go beyond that, I think we can say that our education system is deeply patriarchal in its outcomes, right? And so we have education, we have religion, we have the legal system. And so if you can shape people's understanding of justice or what is right or what is normal, what is divine, you have so much power, right? And so I think the fight of feminism is always to confront that power, to name that power, and then to show what mis- and disinformation looks like.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned schools. So I actually have a number of questions for you about schools that I'm going to get into. I'm going to read a short quote from page 43, which is the chapter where you talk about schools. You say, "Boys feel silenced, displaced, or erased in schools and culture, but it's important to distinguish between this perception and the structural imbalances that continue to center boys in favor of men, particularly if they're white. It's important to say out loud that the way they feel doesn't reflect the reality of enduring centrality and its benefits that are baked into curricula, media, social norms, and the practices of educational and corporate institutions." Yes. I think, you know, you go on to talk about how we treat male supremacy and male-centered cultures as neutral. And so then if we move away from that, it seems like male oppression. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think I've written a lot, you know, I think I've written a lot about the boy crisis in education, which is a cyclical one. It comes up every 20, 25 years. It has for over 100 years. During that 100-year period, girls and women have outperformed men academically the whole time, right? It isn't like a new issue. The problem we have right now, though, is that fewer and fewer men are opting into higher education. And I describe that as male flight that mirrors men leaving teaching because there are too many women in teaching, men fleeing to economics because there are too many women succeeding in the social sciences, men fleeing to STEM because it's high status, and you know, arts and humanities cause a lot of discomfort for them. Like, there are lots of male flight dynamics in the society, and I would categorize the education crisis for boys as one of those. But even within that context, when you look at schools, you basically have a two-tiered system for boys and girls. For the girls, it's still merit-based. The girls, you know, they're evaluated and their lives are often shaped by the grades they get, their performance of academic prowess or goodness. Whereas the boys, even if they don't do that, they still exist in a status-based system, where they, even if they aren't academically succeeding, they can achieve high status through athletic pursuits, for example, right? Like being really fine athletes, or they can self-segregate into STEM areas where they will ultimately be far better compensated and just have higher status in general in education and life. And so that's just one kind of way in which the idea of a boy crisis is insufficient to explain what's going on, because it repeatedly ignores the status-based cultural capital that boys and men have. The other thing too is we know that colleges in their admissions have been artificially gender balancing for 20 years at least. Right. And so that we never talk about it in that way. As a matter of fact, a lot of advocates right now, like Scott Galloway, are saying maybe we should have, you know, the equivalent of affirmative action for men in colleges. We've had it. We've had it for 20 years. Schools have been artificially balancing numbers, particularly elite schools. And I think that's actually even more corrosive to social life and political life and gender polarization, that artificial, you know, balancing that privileges boys. So I think that we mask all of those privileges. We pretend they don't exist. We act like it's all normal. But kids know. They understand what's going on. They intuit what's going on. They have psychological responses to what's going on. And I don't think we can hide it as easily anymore, because there are a lot of people talking about it. Before, there weren't as many.
Yeah. And I mean, I would add to your affirmative action for the past 20 years. I mean, we've always had affirmative action for white guys in school.
Yeah.
But while we're talking about schools, I have a particular axe to grind with schooling, because it is something I am dealing with every single day. It's something that had me up at 5:30 this morning
oh,
on a school
no.
project. So, you know, my husband and I have a truly equitable relationship. And as you know, it's a lot of work to get there. It's lots of conversations and lots of pushing back on like social norms. I have been shocked at how aggressively our children's schools
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Impose like this misogynistic stuff on us. So I'll give you an example. So my kids go to a progressive, ostensibly feminist school. And one of the things that they talk about is that, you know, parents have to be involved. So the expectation is that parents are going to volunteer at the school. They're going to participate in the classroom. You know, a lot of parents will come in and like teach classes. It's wonderful when you describe it like that. But if I describe it honestly, the expectation is that mothers will do that. And if dads never do it, it's fine. So it's like every parent has to participate. But if only the mom does it, whatever, they don't care. So really what's going on is that this wonderfully progressive school has imposed an additional burden on mothers. And, you know, I see it, the emails come to me, the requests to chair this committee come to me, you know, the requests to teach this or that class come to me. And so I'm constantly like having to forward stuff to my husband, and then he's having to, be like, well, I can teach this thing. And then of course they say, what a great dad you are.
Right.
I'm just a normal mom, and God forbid I don't show up for something. Can you talk a little bit about, I think schools are a very significant driver of inequality, but just more broadly, how our social institutions impose inequality even on people who are actively fighting it.
I mean, I think all of us that are in this world of naming to try and change things have had this experience as parents. I've written about it in every single book that I've written or contributed to. One of the first things I ever wrote was for a book called The Good Mother Myth, and it was about school volunteering and why I refused to do it, which doesn't make you any friends either, right? Because your friends are doing it. And it's hard to swim against that tide and say, listen, if we don't disrupt this, then we're going to continue to subsidize the wage gap and, the frictions that you're having if you're a working woman in a hetero marriage with your spouse because you are bearing the disproportional burden of having children in school, which is what you're describing, right? I mean, I think that this is one of the invisible subsidies that schools deliver to boys and men, which is to socialize children to expect women's free labor and to prioritize men's paid labor. I think the example that I write about a couple of examples in this book, but I just remember sitting there at one of these events, and there were lots of dads at the event, unlike often, but this was a sporting event, and so the dads were there, and lunch was being served after, and there were only moms serving the food, and the dads were sitting at the tables, waiting to go to the line and get their food after the kids. And one dad, I did not go serve food, and was sitting at the table with the dads, and he got very kind of huffy and stood up and was going to go over to get his food. And he said, some of us have to work, very loudly.
Oh my
And
God.
I just thought, well, first of all, yeah, we're all working, like all of us. And those women are also working. And you are literally just an asshole. Like I, you know, but it that's common, right? Like he felt that he had to get back to his office and, he had to be there. And even the system of volunteering preferences families with women who don't work for pay in their own homes, right? So that the women who are working, particularly if they're working jobs like being a FedEx driver, right? There was a mom in a single mom FedEx driver. She couldn't come to any events. Right. She couldn't come to any of the parent meetings in the day, in the morning, mid-morning, lunch. Like it was impossible for her because there was literally no attempt to be made. There was no attempt made to alter the life of the school to reflect much more contemporary realities, particularly for working women and single parents, not just single mothers, but single parents, you know? And so I think that's just a good example, and it's persistent.
Yes. Well, and the thing I was thinking about while you were saying this is we have this idea that, whatever women do is not work. Even when women are working for pay, we conceive of it as like, well, it's pin money, it's extra.
It's extra.
Yeah, like people will ask me what I do for a living, and I'll be like, I'm a writer, and they're like, oh, that's so sweet. I'm like, no, it's literally how we pay our bills. But then anything men do, even leisure, is perceived as vital. So we've built this like whole space where if a man wants to watch a football game and neglect his family all weekend,
Yeah.
that's fine. If a man wants to go on a 5-day fishing trip, like that's work. He has to do that. What is that about?
I mean, I think you described it. I just think that there's this expectation. I mean, there's the default parent expectation, right? And it mainly falls to women still. But that it's an entitlement to time that women don't get as a baseline in society, an entitlement to more sleep, to more leisure, to more prioritization of work. It doesn't really matter. You can look at any of those areas and you can see these gross imbalances. And I'm wondering if I have it here. What was really startling to me when you look at, I'm going to see if I can find out while we're talking. It was about sleep. When you talk about how much sleep people get, certainly in heterosexual marriages, men get more sleep overall, which matters, right? It matters to your health. It matters to your well-being, to your nervous system. But when you step back and you look at the difference in sleep between, in the society, for example, between a white man who's working and a black woman who's working, there's a massive gap in their sleep annually. Massive. It's just, and it's debilitating, right? Because there's just this constant chronic fatigue that women experience. But particularly if you are lower down on the status rungs of the society, if you have less money, you're going to have less time. You're going to have less sleep, which is why Trisha Hersey's sleep ministry it resonated so much with people when she launched it.
Yeah. Have you seen, so there's some research that's starting to come out that's actually suggesting that women may need more sleep than men just to maintain health.
Yes.
And I'm always skeptical of that kind of like gender essentialist stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't know how good the science is behind it, but yeah. You know, we do know that women have a lot of times in their life where they definitely need more sleep, like when they're recovering from giving birth, for example.
Right.
And so it's just like, there's no amount of fatigue that we think is too much for women to endure for men to get rest. And then when we look at, we expand it out, as you noted, with like Black working class women and sleep deprivation, it's like the more suffering a person endures, the less we think they are entitled to the very sleep that can make that suffering manageable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, that like there's a transfer of, like, we're talking about sleep, but really you see it in the GDP, right? You see the way women's domestic and care work just doesn't count as productive labor, right? So it doesn't merit counting literally in the economic system. But when you do that, what you're basically doing is transferring that labor into evident signs of male productivity. Men are able to do what they're doing, which is measured and which is valued and which is considered productive in a capitalist society, because women are doing what they're doing at home, right? And yet there's no metric that really captures that. And so it's literally just a theft, right? It's taking this property that women provide, that women have of their time and labor and attention and care, and converting it on paper into men's work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I see that dynamic even in relationships that are fair. It
mm-hmm.
kind of goes to show that it's not an individual thing. It's a political thing. I've seen it in my own marriage. My husband is a civil rights attorney who does a ton of activism. And like, he's also like a 50-50 dad. But also there will be times when he is, you know, doing like jail support, or he's got a big brief coming up, or he has to, you know, argue something in federal court. And so then what happens is, you know, I'm doing extra child care. I'm cooking the meals that he would normally cook so that he can do this work. And like, that's fine. You know, that's what equity is about. I don't have any complaints about that. But what I have noticed is when we come out of these times where he's done all of this really valuable activism, I end up feeling bad about myself because I'm like, he's doing so much to improve the world and I'm not doing as much, when in reality, I'm the one enabling him to do that.
Right, because you're trying to be a good spouse and a good mom, and you're just doing the things that have to get done.
Yeah, but we don't see that as valuable. We don't see that as like a contribution. So I want to talk to you a little bit about sort of the trivialization of women's issues, particularly reproductive rights. So on page 115 of your book, you say, when a man says he's worried about the economy, he's treated as a neutral, pragmatic person. When a woman voices concern over reproductive rights, she's labeled unsophisticated or niche. His gender remains invisible, unmarked, and hers is all that is seen. I mean, I can't tell you how much this resonates with me because in the lead up to the 2016 and 2020 elections, my main work was journalism about reproductive rights. And I cannot tell you how many men I have gotten into fights with who told me that, I was out of control and harming leftist politics by calling out men who were not sufficiently invested in preserving abortion rights. There's always those Democratic politicians who are anti-choice. And these men would get so mad at me, and you're crazy, and we're never going to lose abortion, and you need to focus on things that actually matter. I'm sure you can guess how many of them apologized to me when we lost abortion. And but we see this not just with abortion. We see this with anything that is a women's issue. It's depicted as like niche and unimportant. I get emails constantly from people who are like, why don't you write about politics in this moment?
I know, I
Like
know.
everything I write about is politics. Like what?
Yes, I totally that I, all of that. I wrote almost exclusively about reproductive rights for years as well. And also, I'm so familiar with what you're talking about. It's funny. You can't really win because sometimes you get the response that you just described. And then you get the other response, which I've also gotten since writing this book, which is why it's you're too broad. You're being too broad. I think you should focus on women's issues. And that's just all you're doing is telling on yourself there, right? And I mean, I think the point is that for a serious class of political actors, including progressive men, liberal men in politics, it's only really politically legible if it centers men. If it centers women, it's negotiable. If it centers Black people, it's negotiable, right? And so there's never a point at which the fundamental rights of that they would defend are put at risk for themselves.
So I had a reader and someone I like who's left like insightful comments. Like I don't want to denigrate this person, but she emailed me and she was like, the left has focused too much on identity politics and that I hope we can move beyond that. And I wrote her back and I said, well, you may not know this, but that's actually a racist dog whistle because, what you're really saying is that we focus too much on the issues that affect, Black people, trans people, women. And she quickly responded, was like, no, I don't mean it that way. I just mean, only focusing on those issues and focusing on this politics of grievance. And I finally just kind of stopped responding because I found myself getting so angry and I couldn't really articulate why, but I think you've just articulated it for me, which is we're treating these human rights issues that affect real living human beings as negotiable and trivial. And the stuff that affects white people, we are never framing as identity politics.
Well, and also I think that that woman is a perfect example, and you see this everywhere. You see this in the pages of the New Republic. You see it, weekend editorials. There's never the acknowledgement that the pivotal identity that is assumed to be neutral is white and male and straight and cis, right? That is not an identity. And it's only when you point out that identity and that gets so uncomfortable that you have now named an identity that there's this backlash, this whiplash, right? Because, I grew up in a political environment and been writing for decades now where you could say Black women vote this way, gay men vote that way, but no one said straight cis white men vote this way. It was just the baseline for what voters do, And so I think that it's just important to say the only really important identity to be talking about if you're worried about identity politics is the one that is erased repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly.
I really like I just want to emphasize that because what we don't see as identity are the identities that are the most relevant.
Yeah, I mean, people are gonna engage in their, again, identity protective cognition, which is what happens, that defensiveness and that aggression being made uncomfortable.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little more about the gendered backlash and sort of the general political backlash that we're experiencing. I want to tell you my perspective, and you can tell me if you agree or if you think I'm wrong. My perspective is we've seen a lot of really positive, rapid progress over the last some number of years. And so now we're in a backlash where the people who have power are trying to grab as much of it as they can. And I think that it can be helpful to recognize backlash as like part of what happens when we're making change rather than like the end of change. How do you feel about that? What do you think?
I mean, I think backlash always levels up, right? Every the most conservative people, spokespeople for the administration, for example, they're all leading profoundly feminist lives. All the women are, you know, they've gone to school, they have their own bank accounts, they've probably rented or owned their own houses. They're very happy to enjoy the fruits of other people's labor that way. So I think we should acknowledge that for sure. And as you said, and you know, the backlash is happening because we've been effective, not because we've been ineffective. You know, and I just think that things keep adapting. Movements adapt, ideas adapt, people adapt. So we're just in the middle of this very tumultuous transition stage. And I mean, I'm probably not as optimistic as some people because I think we're at a really scary inflection point. But I do think that there are just inexorable things happening. And it's not even so much that we have to do or say extraordinary revolutionary things, but that we just live our lives as the people that we are. Because that's how you make change.
I like that advice. I know you said you're probably not as hopeful as some people, and I think a lot of people feel that way. But I mean, you're still writing, you're still speaking,
Yes.
and so that to me suggests quite a lot of hope. And I guess sort of my final question for you, and I want to frame this a little bit because, like most of us, I spend a lot of time on social media because my job requires it. And what I'm seeing a lot is I'm seeing a lot of very certain, very authoritative statements from people who have done activism for like 6 months and who I don't think really know what they're talking about, but they're very confident that like their pronouncements about what's going to happen and what we do and all that are true. So I really like to ask people who have been doing this and writing about this for a long time, what do they want people to know in this moment? And like, how do we be effective? If you could transmit something to all the activists who want to do
Oh my
well,
gosh, it's such a hard question.
but no pressure.
Well, first of all, I want people to know that as individuals, there are real limits to what any of us can do. The strength we have is in knowing when to pass the baton and step back and rest and recalibrate and then get back in and take the baton from someone who has to do the same thing. This is a very, very, very long fight we're engaged in. And I know the feeling of wanting to do as much as you can all the time, right? Because you feel so deeply about what you're witnessing or experiencing. But that's not really sustainable. And so one of the reasons I wrote The Resilience Myth was to really encourage people to step back and away from the hyper individualism of the heroic narratives of making change or revolution or resilience, and to consider that the real roots of the resilience of our movements, which, you know, is centuries, it's intergenerational, it's finding solidarity and community with people. Because none of us can do it alone. It's just not possible, you know? And there's great love and joy and wonder in all of that, even when things are horrible and hard. You know, you have to be able to find other people that you can be with and relax with who just understand what you're experiencing and what why you do the work you do without friction and without pushback, because that's what sustains you.
I think that's great advice. I like to reflect on all the good things that trying to improve the world, even just a little bit, have brought into my life. I'm talking to you right now, and that's
I know we met.
I know. Yeah. So, you know, I think there's hope if we make it, and there's change if we come together to demand it.
It's hard, but we all do it, you know.
Yeah.
And honestly, I have never, there's no, they're very, like, in my, like, literally now decades, there's really, really kind of one memory I have in the many, many, many memories that isn't one in which people doing this work have maintained their sense of humor, have carried each other through dark times, or, you know, we know we all have friends doing activist work, and it can get overwhelming and exhausting and frankly depressing. But when that happens, I know who to call to say, hey, I'm feeling this way. And they're like, I totally get it. And then they'll make me laugh and remind me of something. And then I'll course correct, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's a good place for us to end this. Soraya, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for talking to me and for reading the book. I really appreciate it.
You know, we're so lucky to have you out there in the world writing and teaching us all.
Yeah, you too. I was so happy when I got to Substack, which I had delayed for a very long time, and found you. So
yeah, well, and so I'm going to put all of Soraya's information in the show notes, including her Substack, which is really spectacular. It's like a semi-regular injection of new thoughts and philosophy, which I love. And of course, the book is amazing. You should go out and buy it and read it right now and get it for everyone. You know, whether you're new to feminism or you're an old pro, it's great. And I also think it might be the book to give to your Republican friends, because it really does make a very compelling argument. So listeners, thank you for listening. And I will be back with you next week. And Soraya, just thank you again.
Oh, thank you. And I hope you have, like, warm weather soon.